Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. And just for you, this is BreadboxMedia.com. For both heaven and earth, and both body and soul. Very good to be talking to you again on Setting the Record Straight. This is Charles Coughlin. Today is a good day on Setting the Record Straight. We're going to visit an illuminated age, an age of light. We're going to visit the greatest of centuries. It was the summit of the High Middle Ages, the time of the glory of Christendom. But wait, the Protestant Reformation was still 200 years off. There were no Protestants around. This was actually the greatest glory of Catholicdom. It was a time of amazing achievements, the 13th century. In the centuries before this, the Church had protected the people from tyrannical kings and emperors, and the Catholic Church was the most significant influence in civilizing the knights and barons. During the so-called Dark Ages, these men had been forced to spend most of their time fighting. When the Viking attacks ceased, the feudal lords turned to fighting each other. So the Catholic Church instituted two customs. One was the peace of God. The second was the truce of God. The peace of God forbade the lords from attacking certain people and areas, such as monasteries. The truce of God forbade warfare at certain times of the year, such as Lent and Advent. Gradually, both the peace and truce of God were extended until feudal warfare was greatly reduced. I guess what they did during Lent was practice, establishing good habits that spilled over to the rest of the year. You've heard about the rules of warfare. They do exist. The Church, during this time, worked to establish those rules, to make the fighting become less brutal and to encourage men to use their weapons only against the enemies of Catholicdom instead of against each other. Out of this initiative grew the institution of chivalry, a code of Christian conduct for knights. In all things, the knight was expected to be honorable, courageous, to protect the weak, and to defend the rights of the Church. Chivalry, in this new sense, rested on a vow. It was this vow which dignified the soldier, elevated him in everyone's esteem, raised him almost to the level of the monk in medieval society. As if in return for this vow, the Church ordained a special blessing for the knights in the ceremony called the Blessing of the New Soldier, Benedictio Novi Militis. At first, the form of this was very simple, but it gradually developed into an elaborate ceremony. Before the blessing of the sword on the altar, many preliminaries were required of the aspiring knight, such as confession, a vigil of prayer, fasting, a symbolic bath, an investiture with a white robe for the purpose of impressing on the candidate the purity of soul with which he was to enter upon such a noble career. Kneeling before the priest, he pronounced the solemn vow of chivalry, at the same time often renewing the baptismal vow. The one chosen as godfather then struck him lightly on the neck with a sword. The dubbing, in the name of God and St. George, the patron of chivalry. In the time that when the truce of God was in force, there was experienced a long contest of the Church against the violence of that age, before the Church succeeded in curbing the savage spirit of the feudal warriors, who prior to this recognized no law but that of brute force. In later stages, unfortunately, chivalry became a mere court service. What ended the age of the chivalric knight in the late 1400s was the advent of gunpowder and the general use of firearms in battle. Chivalry rapidly disintegrated, and finally disappeared altogether. But that was later, back in the glorious century. Good things were happening. Another great advance of the time was the freeing of the serfs. New technological inventions made it possible for an individual man to work more land, so that more food could be produced by fewer men. Farmers had more free time, and were not so closely tied to the land. The church had always acted to protect the serfs from ill treatment by their overlords. Now she began freeing whatever serfs were still working on lands owned by abbeys and bishops. These abbeys and bishops became very generous landlords. Gradually, the nobles followed the church's example, so that more and more men came to own their own land. Education began to spread during this time. Parishes started to open their own schools. One of the things that needs to be set straight was a criticism of the Catholic Church from Protestants, that the Catholic Church tried to keep the people in ignorance so they would not question the decision of the bishops. The exact opposite is true. Whereas the Roman Empire had excellent schools, those had completely disappeared with the fall of the empire. People, no matter what their rank, had retreated into illiteracy and the resulting ignorance. This is where the church came in. Without the church, education would have not existed. Literacy would have not existed. Did the Catholic Church chain the Bible and keep it from the common man? That's a severe distortion of the truth. Let's set it straight. How do you read the Bible if you're not literate? And how do you become literate? The people that were literate were taught to read by the Catholic Church, and often taught to read using the Bible. Also at this time, the great universities, such as those which St. Thomas Aquinas taught, flourished in a network throughout Western Europe. The practice of science that we in modern times would recognize as science, based on the scientific method fully articulated, had its beginnings during the High Middle Ages, especially through the efforts of a group of incredible intellects that flowered during that time. Thomas Aquinas, Albert the Great, Albertus Magnus, and his star pupil, St. Thomas Aquinas, and brother Roger Bacon, Dr. Miracle, Dr. Mirabilis, who learned to observe and experiment with nature. If historians have to credit one man with perfecting the scientific method, they often pick the monk, Roger Bacon. Bacon's book entitled The Secrets of Art and Nature contains predictions of such inventions as steamboats, balloons, cranes, submarines, microscopes, telescopes, and gunpowder. Note that his title was The Secrets of Art and Nature, because science in those days was considered part of the arts. The arts in those days were recognized to require order, discipline, skill, and sweat and tears. Thomas Edison would be proud. Roger Bacon formulated the laws of the refraction and reflection of light. It was harmonious that Bacon was studying light, because the 13th century was an age of light in several meanings of the term. It was an age of illumination, an illuminated age. I'll talk more about that in the next segment. Bacon was active in many areas. Bacon wrote a whole book to prove the absurdity of magic. What we consider the area of art, which includes literature, reached new heights during the High Middle Ages. You know, you and I are sitting here in the 21st century. How can we know these people? How do you really get to know these people that lived so long ago in the 13th century? If you really want to go back and get in touch with them, as if we were sitting in a comfortable living room with tea and cookies between us and talking to them, you can almost do that. If you read with pleasure what they read with pleasure, take a look at the three most read books of the 13th century. Beside the Bible, of course. Reading those books and knowing the pleasure that people took in them then would tell you a lot about those people. Of course, they read the Bible, but what other things did they read with pleasure? Yes, the Bible was very frequently the subject of study and daily contact in one way or another by all classes of people. But the three most read books were Reynard the Fox, The Golden Legend, and The Romance of the Rose. Renard the Fox is one of the funniest books ever written. Its satire was aimed at its own time, but there's plenty of application to ours. Critics have at all times been ready to praise Renard the Fox. What Cardinal Newman said about reading classical books applies to these three. It pleases in childhood, in youth, in middle age, and even in declining years. Since it appeals to all ages, it's sort of compared to Gulliver's Travels or Don Quixote. They're stories about animals. They're not dressed up as men in the skins of beasts, but are thoroughly true to their characters. The second book is the famous The Golden Legend, written by Jacobus de Voragine, a Dominican preacher and writer. The book was a hit at first and continued to be the most widely read book, except for the Bible, during the 14th and 15th centuries. The book contains the lives of the greater saints of the church since the time of Christ and details the wonderful things that happened in their lives, some of which, of course, were mythical, but all of them containing marvelous stories. It says a lot about the character of the people of the 13th century, that they loved this book. The last of the three was called The Romance of the Rose, and it's not so well known today, but after it was published in the 13th century, it continued for more than two centuries to be the most read book in Europe. Everyone with any pretense to literary taste considered it necessary to be familiar with it. In this book, just like in the other two, one is brought face to face with the fact that men and women have not changed so much over the centuries. For instance, the question of too great a love of money. A passage from The Romance of the Rose says, "If those who heap up wealth would show fair love to others, they would go through life beloved, and thus would reign sweet happy days." Well, let's you and I continue our sweet happy days after the break.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is redboxmedia.com. Why are we calling the High Middle Ages the Bright Ages? Why do I call this the Age of Illumination, especially the 13th century? Well, let's set the record straight. From 962 Anno Domini to 1321, Europe enjoyed one of the most magnificent flourishings of culture the world has seen. In some ways, it was the most magnificent. And this was not despite the fact that the daily tolling of the Catholic church bells provided the rhythm of men's lives, but because of it. Because people believe they lived in a comic world, that the world is redeemed from sin. It's a happy world, wherein the Savior had triumphed over darkness and death. They could love that world. They were pilgrims at heart, yet loved their native lands, their town walls, their hillsides, their festivals. They enjoyed the freedom of hope. They were not people pressed to death with the urgency to create heaven upon earth. A longing that always ends in despair, or in the gulag. How could this be? Giving up instant gratification should produce a population of sad people, or seething villains, or something miserable, which Americans with their dropout factories and nearly 3 million incarcerated men know nothing of. Besides, don't we all believe in inevitable social progress? Everything must have been terrible in the past, at least terrible compared to today. Do you feel that you're progressing morally with every tick of the clock? Do you? It was a grand age. It was inevitable, given the philosophy of the Catholic Church, a loving care and charity for all men, friend and enemy. Why didn't it happen? One question you can ask, why didn't it happen sooner? After all, this is 1,200 years after Christ. It might have, if it were not for three things that the Catholic Church and Catholics had no control over. The first of these were the invasions of the old empire by Germans and Slavs and others. Now, some of these invaders had been converted and were attracted by the high culture of the Roman cities in Gaul, in Italy, in Greece. Some, like the Huns, were spurred by the love of marauding. Still others, like the Vandals, blazed across the continent, yet eventually settled down to stable kingdoms under law. These incursions lasted many centuries, and life was dark and terrible in times and places in those centuries, till Otto the Great turned the tide, defeated the Magyars in 954. And until those seacoast and river-pillaging Vikings were brought to the Catholic faith. Until that happened, it made trade difficult and costly. Economy shriveled, coinage vanished, people had to live on what they got from the land. With a poor climate and empty purses, there was often little enough to eat. Peasants were reduced to serfdom, trading their labor and freedom for whatever poor protection the local lord could provide. And then it was dangerous to go to sea, and this severed the Greek East from the Latin West. The chaos might have been overcome from the East. The Byzantine Empire in Constantinople didn't fall until 1453. And it would have helped had the empire in Byzantium been strong and outward-looking. It wasn't. It was not only pressed upon by Eastern tribes, but more importantly, it had to resist the second factor, the jihadist Islam, the jihad of Islam. You got to remember that in the days of St. Augustine, say 400, all of Africa, north of Sahara, including the Nile Valley, from the sea to the heart of the Sudan, was Greco-Roman in culture and mainly Catholic in faith. St. Augustine was an African and died as a bishop of Hippo Regius. That's now in Tunisia. Alexandria in Egypt was a scholarly capital of the world. The wildfire of Mohammedism swept it away, and an ancient civilization extending from Spain to Persia was no more. So the Byzantine Empire never had the power to return Greek learning to the West and unite the lands under one law. It had enough to do at home. The West was on its own. It looked pretty hopeless, except for one thing. The West had something wonderful and precious secreted away. It had monasteries hidden away, Irish monks clinging to the craggy outposts on the western edge of the known world, on the coast of Ireland, clinging to the coastline in stone beehive-shaped monastic cells, where the monks preserved all they had of the great learning of the past, the Bible, the great classics of Latin and Greek literature. St. Columbkill and St. Columba would return and rescue Europe, those two and an army of other literate monks, teachers, scholars. They would all come east from the islands into Europe, planting the seeds for the great age to come, and refresh and restore Catholicism from the cultural drift it had suffered in illiterate times. They would bring the light of a brilliant literary culture back to its home. Not from the East, rescue didn't come from the East. The cultural rebirth of Western Europe came from its far western outer edge, from these hidden enclaves of high culture, the Irish monks. The third and last thing that delayed the Catholic world's age of illumination was a subtle one. Bad weather. The earth had cooled. The cooling explains the barbarian invasions, because the barbarians and their cattle were cold and hungry. In the center of one very cold winter, the Rhine River froze solid, so the barbarians could cross wherever they pleased. The Roman legions, stretched thin, couldn't do anything about it. And the barbarians came south in great numbers, desperate, hungry. The cold weather caused failed harvests. People grew sickly, life expectancy dropped, population shrank, because cities depend on stored grain. So town life withered away. People can't afford the division of labor that allows for scholars, accountants, merchants, etc. Everybody goes back to the land. They have to eat. When some of these factors were overcome, Catholic doom was ready for its grand resurgence. Catholicism had scrubbed away most of the late Greco-Roman prejudice against manual labor. Remember Benedict and his monastic rules? Monks, whatever their background, worked the land. They worked hard. They cleared the thick, damp German forests of trees and stumps. They drained the marshes. They dug wells, built granaries, planted vineyards, and shared and communicated technological innovation among themselves in a network extending across Europe. In England, the monks arrived in 600, and it was a far different landscape than the beautiful landscapes we are familiar with today. When the monks arrived, it was a marshy area full of fens, which is a kind of marsh, half pond, half marsh. There was just a lot of unusable area, unsatisfactory for agriculture. And through centuries of labor, actually over 900 years, the monks created by hand the beautiful English countryside that we think of with the hedgerows and the beautiful stone bridges. Think of pictures of Stratford-on-Avon. Of course, this beautiful land, especially the best of it, in the 16th century, was suddenly and cruelly ripped away from them by Henry VIII, who decided to become a Protestant. But the luminous 13th century was an age of many monks, and they retained a healthy respect for hierarchy and law. Think about what it might be like to build an economic hotspot where nothing but black furs and mosquitoes had been, without a clear and effective chain of command. At the same time, they inherited this particular revelation that Christ came for all men, not only for the rulers. This ethic exerted a powerful influence on the villages that grew up around the monasteries, and then upon the medieval life generally. Christ himself was obedient unto death. Of course there was some wickedness and selfishness. That's always with us. But the people of the Middle Ages knew that the soul of a peasant was no less worth saving than was the soul of a duke or a king. The irrepressible movement of the Middle Ages was toward freedom. Thank goodness around year 1000 the weather warmed up a bit and the Vikings began to settle down to civilized life. What lay ahead then was a vast improvement. It was an age of light. What shall we look for first in all the light? How about the cathedrals? The sermons in stone, the Gothic cathedrals. The men of the Middle Ages didn't build their cathedrals to be squat, dark, ghoulish structures, illustrations of fear and ignorance. We have to scrub from the church walls the smoke of the later Industrial Revolution. And they certainly didn't share modern man's desire who aspires to work in a steel cage or a cubicle. No, the medieval master builders wanted light, because their faith taught them to want it. For the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. The idea of light from divinity is as old as Genesis. The first thing God made was light. Let there be light. Christ, too, in John's Gospel, is called the light that comes into the world. So Catholics, taking their clue from Scripture, saw light as the noblest thing in creation. Not just the light of the sun, but the light of the intellect. There was a man who really took it to heart. He was a powerful abbot in Paris named Suger. He wanted to build a chapel worthy of the patron saint of France, Saint-Denis. So he decided to take the architectural innovations of the last two centuries, that's vaulted ceilings, pointed arches, and put them together to pour light into a sanctuary such as no one had ever seen before. Remember, they didn't have the materials we do, reinforced steel, fiberglass, super light mixtures of concrete. The problem for Suger and for builders generally for the next two or three centuries was how to build high, span broad interior spaces, and remove stone from walls and replace it with glass without having the roof cave in or the walls buckle. They came up with ingenious engineering solutions. They both worked and were beautiful. You've probably seen some of them.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. This is BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight once again. Or on other occasions like this one, bringing forth neglected knowledge, bringing it to light again. Knowledge about that most glorious of centuries, the 13th century, when the light of the Catholic faith burned the brightest. Light. Our subject is light, different kinds of light. The light of reason was at its peak, the golden age of scholasticism. Thomas Aquinas, Albert the Great, Friar Roger Bacon, and other luminous names of the golden age of scholasticism. The light of prosperity was glowing comfortably. The light of a time of men rendered so peaceful that their wars were minor wars compared to other times. The brilliant 13th century. The light of the Catholic Church. Of a flock of people united within Christ's great gift to us, of a radiant Catholic Church, and of a people brought together to share knowledge, to communicate. For people were unified by the shapely classical order of the clearly proportioned Latin language. In this warm period, men were inspired by the golden light of the sun. And we were talking about the Gothic cathedrals, the great invention of the master builder, Suger, the Frenchman. And we had just been discussing before the break how he set out to solve the problem of bringing more light into the churches, to bring more light through the stained glass windows so that every color of the spectrum, every color of God's covenant with us and all creatures, the rainbow, could play across the faces and hands of all the congregation that crowded the cathedrals in those days. At every mass, those cathedrals were jammed. So you and I are thinking about light and the source light, the origin light, God's light. The great multifaceted abbot Suger was not the architect of Saint-Denis, the first Gothic church, the prototype for later Gothic cathedrals. No, he was the patron, but he was the fuse, the power, the vision. There were two architects who did the actual design. These three men were confronted with a great challenge of structural design to make the supports for this immensely weighty, very tall building. They wanted to design pillars and supports that were slender, sturdy, powerful, but thin, slender, delicate, so that the maximum amount of light could enter the cathedrals, so that they did not occlude the sunlight. The great problem for Suger and for builders generally for the next two or three centuries was how to build high, span broad interior spaces, and remove stone from walls and replace it with glass. Without having the walls buckle or the roof cave in, they came up with ingenious engineering solutions. I've always looked at those cathedrals and wondered whether they were inspired by the marvelously beautiful and strong design of the exoskeleton of insects. Whatever the source of inspiration, these designs were beautiful and they worked. You've probably seen some of them. They're the flying buttresses, spindles of stone thrust out from the exterior walls like the spokes of a wheel, the rope-like interior ribs of marble, perfectly hewn, often alternating colors, white, pink, green, gray, reaching up along pillars to the roof in slender curves, the blocks not mortared but set in place by the magic of balance and gravity. Maybe you've seen the lacework of stone tracery setting off the windows stained in deep blue and red and green and gold, rose windows with the mathematical complexity of a magnificent flower. They are like a kaleidoscopic lens into paradise. It's a miracle how they made them. What about why? Why did they build them this way? Well, the great abbot Suger wrote something about his work that should arrest our attention. These verses were engraved on the doors of Saint-Denis. All you who seek to honor these doors, marvel not at the gold and expense, but at the craftsmanship of the work. The noble work is bright, but being nobly bright, the work should brighten then the minds, allowing them to travel through the lights to the true light, where Christ is the true door. The golden door defines how it is imminent in these things. The dull mind can rise to the truth through material things. and is resurrected from its former submersion when light is seen. So wrote the man to whom in great part we must give credit for giving birth to the Gothic style. Here's a medieval man reveling in both the bright and beautiful things of the world and the infinitely brighter things of heaven. The beauty of the world is not rejected, but ordered toward the beauty of heaven. Deep calls into deep and light into light. Some people have said that colors have a theological meaning, the one inaccessible light of God, made manifest, incarnate in the objects of our sight. So the stained glass windows are meant to reveal a trace, just a trace, of that luminous feast in paradise. Now, if these glories were confined to the church or to a precious manuscript with its indigo and emerald and scarlet, how did this affect the life of the common people? What we find hard to fathom now is that those common people were the ones that built the churches. We're not talking about huge, indistinguishable blocks of stone hauled up the side of a pyramid by sledge and slave to commemorate a dead pharaoh. We're not talking even about the Athenian Parthenon, but a group of master sculptors hammering at the pediment. We're talking about free men, troops of them, moving in from place to place, paid pretty well, masters of their crafts, for local laborers for the less skilled work. We don't know the names of most of those, and that too is telling, for the work is not designed and mandated by potentates far away. It is true folk art, maybe the most muscular and magnificent folk art the world has ever known. You have to remember that the church was the heart of the life of those common people, and those people dwelt in the shadow and the reflected gleam of these places of beauty. You have to remember what it was to own, with the rest of your townsmen, to own a structure that pierced the skies with its grandeur, yet that also welcomed you in, and that stood an eloquent witness when you were born, when you were married, when you had children, and when you died. It was yours. It was inherited by each generation. If you lived in a town with a cathedral that had built a cathedral, it was yours. The whole of Gothic cathedrals are scrawled over with playfulness. Maybe over here, working away, you'll see a gangly boy, maybe named Watt, not yet a master, chiseling the leer of a dragon, whose mouth will gush rainwater and will keep the roof from leaking. Over there, a carpenter works at a coffered wooden ceiling, gouging out for decoration and for affirming the goodness of all God's creatures, the flowers and animals of his native land. Back toward the sanctuary, a priest may be asking the glaziers for a rose window in the east based on the number 8, since the 8th day is Easter, the day beyond all days, the day of resurrection. The townsfolk who've contributed much to the building will also gain from it. People will come to see the church, and people will need food and drink and lodging, for the church is also an expression of town pride and love. And if it takes 50 or 60 years to build, or more, the people bequeath the project to their children. It is their great artistic and economic triumph. Where did all that energy come from? It was the Catholic faith that brought that energy into being. These cathedrals have been called sermons in stone, and they're all built to take the light, to provide vast interior supported spaces so that the enormous windows can bring in the light of every color in the spectrum. Will Durant, in his History of Civilization series of books, says that great art is the child of a triumphant faith. Then the sculptures of these Catholic Gothic cathedrals really have no rival anywhere. These sculptures that were an integrated component of the cathedrals were conceived not as an independent, but as one phase of an integrated art for which no language has a name, the adornment of worship. Primarily, the sculpture's function was to beautify the house of God with statuary and reliefs, secondarily to make images or icons to inspire piety in the home. In church sculpture, the preferred material was some lasting substance like stone, marble, alabaster, bronze. But for statuary, the church preferred the lighter substance of wood. Such figures should be borne in processions without agony by sturdy Catholics marching in religious pageantry. Statues were painted as in ancient religious art, and they were often quite realistic. The purpose was to make the worshiper feel the presence of the saint through the image. We're coming up upon a break. We'll take a break in a moment. But first, I want to say that any study of medieval sculpture should begin with an act of contrition. A great part of that sculpture was destroyed in England by Puritan zealots, sometimes even by acts of Parliament, and in France by the art terror of the Revolution. After the Protestant Reformation and the revolutions in France and other places, all through these countries we find headless statues, broken noses, battered sarcophagi, smashed reliefs, shattered cornices and capitals, evidence of a fury of accumulated resentments, resulting in a terrible and sad demolition, a pageant of ruined beauty.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. This is BreadboxMedia.com. We're back after the break. It's unfortunate that we know medieval sculpture only in its desolation. It's not just the iconoclasts that so much of this sculpture was destroyed or damaged in a fury of destruction against sacred images. It's not just that. It's that sometimes today it can only be seen robbed of its context. Indeed, the cathedrals themselves, in a Europe gone secular, gone atheist, gone numb to the spirit, the cathedrals themselves are left standing isolated from their living context. From the greatest century, the 13th century, the age of illumination, when its meaning was robust and alive in a robust and alive Catholicism at full tide. To see pieces of this isolated sculpture standing alone in museums is to misunderstand the art of that spiritual age. It was not meant to be seen in isolation. It was part of a theological theme and an architectural whole, and what might seem crude and ungainly in separation may have been skillfully suited to its context. The cathedral statue was an element in a composition. It was adjusted to its place, intended to follow by elongation the vertical lift of the cathedral lines. The legs were kept together. The arms were pressed to the body. Sometimes a saint was thinned and stretched through the length of a portal jamb. Less often, a horizontal effect was stressed, and the figures over a door might be fattened and flattened, as over the portal of the cathedral at Chartres. Or a man or a beast might be crumpled into a capital like a Greek god, cornered in a pediment. Gothic sculpture was fused in an unrivaled unity with the architecture it adorned. The art of that great age has another characteristic that I must mention. The 13th century, that great century, was filled with an exuberance. Sculptures could express their exuberance. They ventured out of formalism into realism, out of piety into humor, even satire, the zest of earthly life. At the Chartres Cathedral, from the 12th century, figures are somber and rather stiff. At the Cathedral de Reims in France, in the 13th century, they're caught in natural conversation or spontaneous action. The features of the statues are individual. There's grace in their pose. Many of the figures on these two cathedrals resemble the bearded peasants that still meet us in French villages. On the west portal of the cathedral at Amiens, the shepherd warming himself might be a Norman of today. No sculpture in history rivals the whimsical veracity of Gothic cathedral reliefs. And at the cathedral at Rouen, crowded into little quatrefoils, we find a meditative philosopher with the head of a pig, a doctor, half man and half goose, studying another file of urine, a music teacher, half man and half rooster, giving a lesson on the organ to a centaur, a man changed by a sorcerer into a dog, whose feet still wear his boots. Funny little figures crouch under the statues at Chartres. A capital on the Strasbourg Cathedral shows the burial of Renard the Fox. A boar and a goat carried his coffin, a wolf bore the cross, a hare lighted the way with a taper, a bear sprinkled holy water, a stag sang mass, an ass chanted the funeral service from a book resting on the head of a cat. In England, at Beverley Minster, a fox, cowled like a monk, preaches from a pulpit to a congregation, pious geese. Is that exuberant enough for you? So the cathedrals, among other things, are menageries in stone. Almost all animals known to man, and many known only to medieval fantasy, find some little tolerant space in these immense cathedrals that they can inhabit. At Lyon, 16 bulls lower on the cathedral towers. They represent, we're told, the mighty beast that through patient years transported the stone blocks from the quarries to the hilltop church. There's a legend that one day an ox laboring upward fell in exhaustion. The load was precariously poised on a slope when a miraculous ox appeared, slipped into the harness, drew the cart to the summit, and then vanished into the thin supernatural air. A rather endearing feature of cathedrals is that they always found a place for a botanical garden. Next to the Virgin, the angels, and the saints, what better ornament could there be for the house of God than the plants, fruits, flowers of the French or English or German countryside? On some of these cathedrals, the reliefs tell the story of the creation. At Illions, the Creator counts on his fingers the remaining days of the seventh that he took to create the universe. In later scenes, we see him tired with his cosmic toil, leaning on his staff, sitting down to rest, finally going to sleep. This is a sweet portrayal of God that any peasant could relate to. Other cathedral reliefs show the months of the year, each month with its distinctive work and distinctive joy. Others show the occupations of mankind. Peasants in the field or at the wine press, some guiding horses or oxen and breaking furrows or pulling carts, others shearing sheep or milking cows. There's millers, carpenters, porters, merchants, artists, scholars, and a philosopher too, of course. Will Durant writes about the Gothic sculpture that there's a depth of feeling in it, a variety and energy of life, a sympathy with all the forms of the plant and animal world, a tenderness, a gentleness, and grace. A miracle in stone revealing not flesh, but the soul. These sculptures touch you when the bodily excellence of the Greek statuary is lost. Beside the living figures of medieval faith, the heavy gods of the Parthenon pediment seem cold and dead. Gothic sculpture is technically deficient. There's nothing in it that can match the perfection of the Parthenon or the handsome gods and goddesses of Praxiteles. Today, our allegiance to Catholicism, remembering its loveliness, slip us back, bring us back again and again to the great cathedrals, and tip the scales to the beautiful God of Amiens, the smiling angel at Reims, and the Virgin at Chartres. Why did they build so many churches in the 3 centuries after 1000? What need was there in a Europe with hardly a fifth of its present population for these churches so vast that they're now rarely filled even on the holiest of days? How can an agricultural civilization afford to build such costly edifices? The population was small, but it believed. It was poor, but it gave. The construction was financed largely by the accumulated funds of the Episcopal See. In addition, the bishop solicited gifts from kings, nobles, communes, guilds, parishes, and individuals. The cathedrals became the symbol and challenge of their wealth and power. Competition for building funds was keen. If in some of these appeals for funds there was a small amount of pressure, let's draw a little comparisons with ourselves today. They hardly rivaled the intensity that mobilized the public financing of a modern war. How many of our cities have gone deeply into debt, sometimes irrecoverably so, to finance an Astrodome or a football stadium? We might suspect that our own age has a different sense of what divinity we should sacrifice for. From all of the evidence that we have from the 13th century, the people themselves did not feel exploited when they contributed funds.
They hardly missed the mite they individually gave.
But for that mite, they felt a sense of achievement and pride.
A home for their worship, a meeting place for their community, a school of letters for their children, a school of arts and crafts for their guilds,
a pictorial Bible in stone that was designed to be full of light,
whereby they might contemplate in statue and picture the story of their Catholic faith. The house of the people was the house of God.
But what of the question of who really designed the cathedrals? Very few of the designers of cathedrals were priests or monks.
They were professional architects. They called them master builder or sometimes master mason. And these terms reveal the origin of these men. They began as artisans, physically engaged in the work they later directed. We do know the names of many such architects after the year 1000. We know the names of 137 of them, architects of Gothic cathedrals, in medieval Spain alone. And yes, some of them inscribed their names on their buildings, and a few wrote books about their craft. The artists who did the more delicate work, who carved the figures and reliefs, or painted the windows or walls, or decorated the altar, the choir, were not distinguished from the artisans by any special name. The artist was a master artisan, and every industry strove to be an art. Much of the work was distributed by contract among the guilds, to which artists and artisans both belonged. What is most incredible
is that the design and proportions of the cathedral
were based on the human body.
Yes, the proportions of the cathedral and the way it was laid out were not at all what we might think. Calibrated out with measuring rods? No, it wasn't done that way. It was done by a sense of sacred geometry, by a contemplation of organic proportions,
and especially proportions of the human body.
And honor the proportions of the Immaculate Mother of God, and in honoring her, honor all women.
That's an intriguing subject, I know. I'm going to return to it in a Setting the Record Straight program in the future, which will be entitled A Cathedral. We are no longer her at a distance, or he at a distance, or he or her in general. She and he commit themselves to be for each other. This is Charles Coughlin. God bless all.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.